Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Data, analytics, big data science, machine learning, customer insight, behavioral science, blockchain, data ops, data engineering, agile working. Phew, too many terms, too many things to think about. Do you as a leader need somewhere to turn? To hear what other leaders are doing? To hear what really makes a difference in your business? Welcome. The Customer Insight Leader Podcast is here for you. Each episode, we'll be interviewing a different leader in the fields of customer insight, data, and analytics to hear what they really do, what really makes a difference. So settle down, get that cup of coffee, and enjoy the Customer Insight Leader Podcast. Hello and welcome to the Customer Insight Leader Podcast, a place to hear from today's leaders in the fields of customer insight, data science, and analytics. I'm your host, Paul Rocklin, and with me today is Aubrey HB. Yep, that surname is HB like the pencil. Aubrey is the Director of Advanced Analytics for Nationwide Building Society. Since completing her PhD in pure maths, Aubrey's career has evolved into establishing and growing centralized advanced analytics capabilities, ones that can serve an entire organization. And her experience spans roles in telecoms, publishing, entertainment, healthcare, and financial services, all of which I'm sure we're going to come back to and touch on. Aubrey claims that truly transformative data science relies not only on a comprehensive understanding of the mathematics underpinning analytics, obviously a specialism for Aubrey, but also on the computational environment available, the accessibility of the organization, and the quality of the data. So she says she's devoted her career to become an expert leader in all those interrelated aspects. Impressive indeed. And listeners, she will be. Welcome, Aubrey.
Thank you very much for having me.
You are very welcome. I'm looking forward to this conversation. It's a pleasure to be talking to, actually, once again, yet another woman who's a highly mathematical analytics leader. You're definitely a tribe within the data science leadership community. It's becoming a theme on the podcast, and I'm enjoying it. With all my guests, Aubrey, I like to ask them first to tell us a bit about their backstory, where they're coming from, if you like, the career story, so that listeners know where you're coming from, the experience you're drawing on, who you are, really, to start with. So, Aubrey, could you tell us a bit about your career story and how you ended up in the data science leadership role that you have today?
Yes, thank you. So I began my career being very passionate in solving problems with mathematics. That's why I actually went to go get a PhD in mathematics. And it was an area where pure mathematics actually meets computer science. Called computational algebraic topology, rather.
Wow, that's so nice. That's an impressive one. Good one to have.
Yeah, it sounds really good. From there, I ended up wanting to be much more closer to solving real-world problems than academia would normally allow. So I moved to AT&T in their which is a massive United States telecommunications organization for their government solution side of the business, solving a huge host of different types of mathematical solutions for the government. Then I wanted to get closer to kind of the business stakeholders at one point. So I moved over to healthcare. From there, I was recruited as the first chief data scientist for a publishing company called Scholastic. The challenge that I had with that particular environment, as is with other subsequent roles, is that being a chief data scientist is great. You've got access to a lot of data, but you almost never have computational environments where you can actually deploy your mathematics. Okay. So that's where I started to really learn about data management, data architecture, as well as building computational environments that are suitable for scalable enterprise-wide analytics capabilities. I brought that over to SiriusXM, which is an entertainment company within the United States, and grew out a centralized advanced analytics capability that really leveraged the pre-existing analytics functions that spanned across engineering, research and development, marketing, and really brought them together and supplied them with a bit extra enablement power to really make their solutions last and embed much more into the value generation side of the business. Mm-hmm. And from there, I got recruited over to the UK to work for Nationwide, doing exactly the same thing, growing their analytics capability and really enabling everybody who wants to be data-driven across Nationwide.
Wow, what an impressive career with real momentum there. This repeated pattern of people hiring you to be their first chief data scientist and them often kind of not having everything in place, I guess I'm kind of hearing, and I can understand your need to get your hands dirty a bit more with data engineering and getting the fundamentals in place. Anything else that you found has consistently helped you in case there are other people out there facing the challenge of being a first-time chief data scientist for an organization?
I think the important thing is to really remember that at the very core of solving anything with math is that you have structured aspects that are indicative of the principles that you're deploying in math. So when you are looking at data architecture across the board, you have to have those principles in mind in terms of thinking about how you would extract the right data sets and making sure that your data location is closely coupled to your computational environments is the only way that anybody's going to be successful in doing the research and the development and the experimentation for advanced analytics. But then it also enables you to then push things into production and industrialization methods so that those analytics can ultimately be deployed. So I think as long as you just hold true to remembering that those are the key components, there's so much out there in terms of online materials that can help you get started in setting up a compute environment and various other things that I just think keep hammering home that you need those tools and those capabilities all together in order to be able to do your job.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense. It sounds like, as you put it, more holding fast to some of those principles that are kind of non-negotiables in order to have an efficient and effective analytics environment and deployment environment, more than needing to have a really comprehensive data strategy. I guess I know a lot of leaders drawn into those kind of roles or being a CDO for the first time sometimes seem to get kind of drawn into a cycle of endless strategic work for a while before they can kind of get on and really put things into practice. So from what I'm hearing, Aubrey, you're more advising have some of those principles in place, but then start getting on and doing things.
Absolutely. Because unfortunately, the world doesn't want to let you sit in a closet and do nothing for 3 years while you solve for all of the sins of the past. So I've always coupled having a progressive Horizon 3 strategy as the ultimate roadmap, but with the constant need and drive to deliver, even if it's small bits and pieces along the way, in order to show that value that you can bring as a function.
Yeah, but big believer in that. Completely agree from my experience and what I've heard from others as well. You do need that kind of drip, drip, drip of delivery to build your reputation, don't you? As well as knowing the direction you're intentionally going in rather than just making it up reactively.
Yes, exactly.
The other thing I was keen to pick up on, I know you mentioned before that when you started out with that PhD, it was still it's an incredibly impressive title. It's great. Must work wonderfully at dinner parties. You faced the problem that for quite a while, what you were understanding in theory, there wasn't the computational power to enable you to do all that data topology work kind of in practice yet with large scale data. And I learned my craft in those kind of days as well. I wonder, we kind of celebrate, and maybe rightly, the huge progress that's been made in computing power and data storage, the reality of us living in a big data world now. But I wonder if we kind of have the inverse problem now, that because there's such computing power available, relatively affordable data science frameworks available as well, there can be a kind of rush to deploy models and be able to get something out there to cut to code, if you like, without good quality mathematical thinking before. Do you think you benefited from the fact that you had to get the mathematical foundations in place and well thought through first before you could just rush on and start working with the data?
I think I did personally benefit from it, but I also think that it shaped my view of how to lead in this space. I'm very wary of those black box data science codes that you can just throw a bunch of things through and a confidence matrix is going to tell you which of the solutions is the right one when you've never really stopped to ask yourself, is it even answering the question you're attempting to answer? Yeah. And that's, I think, what I kind of realized when I was at AT&T and then looking to get closer to the business is it's actually that subject matter expertise and understanding how the data that gets collected and manifests because of the system, because of the industry, because of the subtle nuances that sit behind what that data actually means in reality. And I think that's where a lot of people take shortcuts, and having that strong principled mathematics background really positions me in a place to want to instill that same level of rigor and mathematical conscientiousness to all of the problems that we try to solve. But I agree with you. I think sometimes, especially with deep learning, it's just easy to get the computer to find a pattern. But what is that pattern that you're ultimately trying to find? And what's the purpose of it? If it doesn't align with what the business problem is, it's great, you know, development, but it's not actually going to get you the value that you're hoping it will.
Yeah, that's well put, Aubrey. Yes, it's like the classic problem when you have something like a PhD student working in a commercial organization, they find something that's theoretically interesting, but not of practical help. So your call out makes good sense. And I remember actually even Donkeys years ago, because I am that old, products like KXEN concerning me, because it was such a focus in the early days on fast development and deployment of models without such a focus on quality. And it was only those who were doing the statistical work really who would find out this model isn't really generalizing well, it does degrade quite quickly, and there wasn't that kind of oversight. Do you find yourself, given your roots, putting that in place as well, that you've got an oversight of deployed models, of data products, whatever language you've used, that makes sure that they continue to work well as well and doesn't see your job as done once it's deployed?
Oh, absolutely. Anybody who's delivering any kind of advanced analytics solutions at this stage needs to have some sort of, well, it's being called AI ops, ML ops. I like to just use the more broad term of analytics ops. You do need to make sure that the model that you built is still appropriate, even after some time period has been in place. And there's always tweaking, there's always refinement. And that's what's really interesting about the space of data science, because it is a science, it is experiment, and it is constantly learning from what your model is ultimately doing in the real world that you bring back in as feedback that allows you to understand how to improve it. And so I think all of that does need to have the frameworks, the constant monitoring that you would put in place using technology. But one of the things that I've also put in place is design authorities and making sure that there's code reviews, that people are sort of double checking each other's thinking, thought process, that if there are holes to poke in an approach, that that's happening up front, more and more, especially in the UK with things like consumer duty coming fast and forward from the regulators, it's going to be very, very important to be able to explain each step of the mathematics that sit behind something that seems very complicated, so that you have that awareness that there's nothing nefarious that is happening to your consumers as a result of humans out of the loop decisioning, even if it's a momentary time when they're out of the loop.
Yeah, no, good point to make. Yeah, you've got that further challenge now beyond the whole decisioning responsibility within GDPR. That's a good call to make. And I'm really glad to hear about that focus, Aubrey. I think also you're right about the code reviews. I've been surprised before now in teams I've worked with and data scientists I've known how many can work in a somewhat agile environment, but the discipline, the rigor of quality retrospectives gets dropped. It's just, let's get on to the next delivery. And without that focus on QA and that You're right, really. In an element, this is the rigor of the discipline of the scientific method still being there, isn't it? It's that you need to embed as well.
Exactly. And it's quite challenging because scientists love to experiment. They love to tinker. Yes. They love to move on to the next thing. And they don't often like to do any kind of documentation or various other things. But that's, I think, the one thing that I found is most transferable across different industries. I hated the expression, but everybody used to say, you know, what happens if you get hit by a bus? You know, what happens to those solutions? And I think it's making sure that everybody understands that it is your responsibility as a corporate citizen and your team's responsibility to make sure that those solutions can be well understood, well transferred, well worked on across the entirety of the team. And the only way you can do that is instilling those best practices to make it easier for handoffs.
Yeah, completely agree. Not called out enough. You're quite right, Aubrey. When we spoke before, I know I was kind of intrigued with the work that you did at AT&T. It's always rather exciting when people are doing work with the US government and you wonder what secrets you might discover. Not that you gave any secrets away. But clearly, some of the work that you were involved in included seeing the power of kind of data tracking, of what you could do in triangulating data sources and being able to track what people are doing. I wonder whether that was pretty early on in your commercial career. I wonder what insight that gave you into the importance of robust data ethics. I know that work that I and others were involved in many years ago, sometimes you'll look back and you'll think, if we had the same rigor of data ethics then as we do now, I might have raised a few more eyebrows at some of that work. Have you seen overreach in what data teams do? And do such ethical considerations shape your work today as well?
For me personally, if there was overreach, it was fully sanctioned and signed off by any bosses that I had in terms of using data to mine everything from exact location that somebody was in, where their cell phone was pinging off different towers, directions that they took home, those sorts of things is some of the analyses I did. Mm. I think the challenge that I have is because there are no regulations, there are no privacy laws anywhere in the United States outside of California, there is really nothing to stop anybody from doing anything within the art of the possible. And so for me personally, that is when I started to recognize the power that data had and where I felt most comfortable deploying my intellectual property. And while it's not technically an overreach, there were certain things that I sat back and said, ooh, I don't know if I'd want this being done to my data.
Yeah.
And that's actually what made me really fall in love with and move over to the UK to join Nationwide is that ethical member-facing mindset within the UK, which has those kinds of data laws that really do protect people much, much more so than anything in the United States. And I just add that I think one of the things that people in this country use in terms of phraseology is data as an asset. Or the monetary value of data. And I don't think that people fully appreciate how much actual behind the scenes data trading and the commodity that data is becoming in countries that don't have those data protection laws in place.
Yeah, absolutely right. I don't think there is wide consciousness of the data broking market. And I don't think there certainly is wide consciousness in the UK of quite what a wild west, if you like, of data protection. It is in a lot of the United States. I think that would surprise a number of people that outside of California, there really aren't similar protections. Perhaps we'll come back to that because I'm keen to come back to your unique perspective as an American now working in the UK. Before I forget, given I've reached that sort of age, I also wanted to hook into what you mentioned about wanting to have the commercial perspective, wanting to get closer to the business. You kind of had it as a bit of an aside and part of the reason why you moved to AT&T and then to some other roles as well. I just wonder how you developed it because you still sound to have been in quite technical roles and I'm sure technically demanding roles. How did you develop the closeness to the business, getting that domain understanding when you also had a lot of technical challenges to face?
Well, I think it's getting to know a network and learning from those people that are the ones that you're helping solve problems for. Because mathematics is, in my view, very agnostic, you know, numbers are numbers, and mathematics can be deployed for any number of different types of problem spaces across an almost infinite domain space.
Yeah, sure.
I that's where I got into really registering that the way the data is collected and the nuances that sit inside of the data that you cannot know just from trying to mine out patterns. You have to understand the specifics that sit behind that kind of data collection is why I wanted to get closer to the business. I wanted to have more of an impact where my work could actually be deployed, be leveraged by my business stakeholders. And I think that's one of the biggest challenges that a lot of data scientists and analytics leaders have, is that the value of what you bring to the table is only as good as what they ultimately deploy. So you have to strike that very close partnership and help them understand where they are in the journey of leveraging analytics and where they could be in the journey. So that was something that I just, probably being a little bit more extroverted than a lot of mathematicians, just started to get to know people and really wanted to get much closer to understanding the business so that I could make my solutions that much better.
Yeah, that makes sense. I wonder how you managed to encourage that in your teams as well, Aubrey. I'm thinking of the challenge that a lot of data leaders have, particularly data science leaders, that a lot of the people who work for you are desperate to keep developing their technical skills and have exciting work to do that they feel will stretch and grow them. And otherwise they might leave and go and work elsewhere. But from what you've just said, I completely agree. They also actually need to understand what's relevant for the business, what will help, and build up that kind of closeness to the business as well. How do you give them enough of the first while to keep them there, while still getting them to engage with that, understand the business, understand the problem side?
That is a great question. So we try to balance it in a number of different ways. First and foremost, the connections that somebody at my level in my position has across the organization gives me a bird's eye view to understand strategically where people are thinking about using analytics to drive value, which then allows me to set out a strategic roadmap of different use cases. And one of the things that I'm constantly looking for is handpicking those use cases that actually would require different mathematical concepts from what my data science team has done in the past. This, I have found, allows them to try out a new approach, do some learning in the job, and also be able to practice what they've learned and solve a business problem to keep that excitement of constantly seeing what's happening in the data science industries real and first and foremost. Now, part of all of that, and one of the things that we do, and you mentioned, you know, the agile light mentality, is we do a lot of stakeholder demos. I want my data scientists to go in front of them and have the conversations, answer all of the questions that they have. But that can come a little bit difficultly for some of those, for some of those folks, because EQ, social awareness, those things are not necessarily in their strongest set of skills at this stage in their career. So one of the things that I've been practicing is around storytelling and storytelling about mathematics, but not being able to use any numbers. So really, you know, just try to get them to come up with the so what, help them with those elevator pitches and help them find that common ground with their stakeholders so that they can be effective communicators about their subject matter in a way that can resonate and be appreciated by those people that they're facing off to the business. And I'm hopeful that in creating that kind of culture and that kind of environment for them, those individuals can understand the benefit of those weird questions that the stakeholder asks, or the did you consider X, Y, and Z, that all of a sudden uncovers some of the preconceived data biases that you wouldn't have anticipated that you needed to go look for. But it is, and it has to be, that balanced marriage of the business and data professionals in order to solve something that's fit for the problem being solved.
Yeah, that makes good sense. And it's interesting that you go there, but it kind of makes sense that the storytelling expertise, I'm immediately thinking of advice and experts like Nancy Duarte and the kind of resonate kind of approach. But that storytelling does bring together a rich understanding of what's relevant, what the need is in the organization, and an unconstrained exploration of the problem space that should lend itself to spotting, oh, this shiny new technical technique might be able to help in that particular problem. I could see where that would be relevant. How do you do the prioritization, Aubrey? Because I can get the value of you handpicking from the use cases. Ah, that would be a great one for Tom, because it would give them a chance to try something new or embed this recent learning. How do you balance that against, you must also be wanting to prioritize the use cases that will build the reputation, make the most value for the organization, that kind of commercial side. Is it just a balance? Is there some other way that you manage to protect prioritizing both impact for the organization and learning opportunity for your team?
Well, the good thing is that the business doesn't care what mathematical method you actually use behind the scenes. Yeah. They care that their problem is being solved. So I think you can have a bit of selective creativity in terms of what you line up. Now, obviously, we're going to go for the most value add and the biggest impact use cases wherever possible. But there is the benefit that data scientists don't want to just stare at the same problem day in, day out without any opportunity to think about anything else. So you can kind of balance giving them something that's going to be very impactful to the organization alongside of a smaller POC side project that gets them that educational opportunity that they were seeking. And so most of our data scientists ultimately work on 2 to 3 initiatives at any one time. So you can really kind of stagger and balance, making sure that they have some that are high value and then some that are more about their individual and career development.
Yeah, that makes sense. That balanced diet absolutely makes sense. Like a majority of the data science leaders who I've interviewed on this podcast, you've also all been worked across a number of different sectors, quite a diverse range. I wonder which approaches or learning have proved the most transferable for you. What have you found most useful in most of the roles that you've done?
I think it goes back to what I said a little bit earlier. Math, to me, is math. On numbers, sorry, you say maths here.
We do say maths. You know, yeah, it's always entertaining to hear math.
Sorry. But it is, in my view, it is agnostic of the industry, of the domain. It's just applying principle thinking to what ultimately is data in very high dimensional space. But that said, I think that the putting in the best practices, ensuring the transferability, ensuring the explainability, that's going to transcend a lot of different industries. And whether or not you work in pharmaceuticals or you work in financial services, places that require that regulatory scrutiny is going to require that. And more industries are going to ultimately get folded into that, I am sure. But I would also say that I think there are key areas that mathematical subdisciplines, as I would call them. So things like natural language processing is widely used across all industries and all domains to solve a huge host of different types of problems. With the prevalence of CCTV cameras, you can go into the same kind of thing with image and video processing. And I would also say that, you know, you're not going to get away from any kind of causal referential analyses and those sorts of things. So I think it's fairly transferable, and that there's just a lot. It's more about what you're deploying, the mathematics, less about the industry, in my view.
Yeah, so that makes good sense, and is reiterates your earlier point on the agnostic nature of math, the transferability of kind of that mindset, as well as any particular techniques. On the rarer side, Aubrey, you are unique, I believe, from my memory, as a guest on this podcast, someone who had an established, successful data science career in the United States before moving across the pond to work here in the UK. Welcome. So your perspective is very valuable. It's always, I think, for all residents of any country, we tend to run ourselves down and spot maybe only what's wrong and not always spot what we should value. So I wonder what you've experienced is different about doing data science work here compared with work in America, both good and bad. What do you notice?
Well, we touched on it a little bit earlier in terms of while it might feel exciting and invigorating for a data scientist to not have to go through a lot of the hurdles and hoops and the things that come with privacy regulations in America, and you can get things done faster. That's not necessarily the best thing because there is no data privacy laws or regulations. So you can find yourself working on solutions where you question your, you know, whether or not you want that intellectual property being used for those particular use cases. Yeah. One of the things that I would say is very different from my perspective coming over to the UK is a really different, healthy work-life balance and a want and a desire for people to have real career growth aspirations and individual development plans. Plans and various other things. I mean, I came from New York, which is, if you make it there, you make it everywhere. It's very dog eat dog. It's very, you got to go out and be the forger of your own destiny. Whereas I think that there's a different kind of responsibility on leaders in the UK to help establish that and give people something to follow, which is a very, from what I've experienced, different approach, especially in the analytics space. And it's one of the reasons why I really like being a leader in this space is setting out that vision and that strategy and getting people to really buy in and feel empowered and enabled to follow you to that horizon three utopia where everything's being analytics driven. And so I think for me, the biggest fundamental difference that I've noticed, there's a lot more attention to the individual on this side of the pond, as I've experienced.
Okay, that's good. That's really interesting. Thank you. Do you think we possibly go too far in that pendulum swing? I think of some conversations I've had with some leaders over the years, not so much recently, actually, but who kind of feel like they have to do all the work to almost spoon feed personal development. And there's kind of not so much responsibility on the individual to own their own career progression. They're expecting the boss to provide all the options for them and they just participate in what's provided. Do you see a healthy balance here in the UK, or do you think we don't have enough of some of your New York drive, but not too much?
No, that's a great question. And it might be a generational thing, actually, more than a cultural dissonance in terms of that self-drive and motivation. I would say that it's hard to answer either way. I don't know that there's too much from my perspective, because I think it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. In my view, the employee is the lifeblood of the organization from now until the future. So I see my position as being one where I should be enabling and developing and growing the best group of employees I possibly can to deliver that to the organization so that they can be the best people that they can be. And if that requires a little extra planning and a little extra articulation of what are those career paths for people to follow, I think that that gives people some guidance that they would not have otherwise. And given how fast everything in data science is changing and the whole industry around this particular space is constantly moving, I think it can be very daunting to people who are starting out to know, what should I do next? What models should I need to know? And what is it that I need to do in order to be promoted through those different ranks. It's a little bit of a wild, wild west right now. And I think that that's why there is that craving of leaders to lay it out a little bit more for them.
Yeah, that makes sense. Well argued. I can see that it is so much choice. It's like the tyranny of choice again, isn't it? That you have a responsibility to be a bit of a wayfinder for your team in terms of what will help them. Yeah, that makes sense. It actually prompts me a question I often end these conversations with, actually, which is I try and protect some time to think about those who are earlier in their career, because about half of the audience who listen to this podcast by age suggests they are earlier in their career, as well as the other half who are a bit more maybe at your stage, at least, if not as old as me. Those who are younger, those who are starting out, given what you've learned along the way and what you see helps your team, what tips would you have for them as to what skills and knowledge they should focus on developing? What might they be missing that would help them?
That is a fabulous question. And I think that I'm just going to preface it with, I think it depends on the individual and what their career aspirations are. Mm. It is completely acceptable and, quite frankly, very marketable to be a subject matter expertise and somebody who really focuses on doing the individual contributions to a project, and especially with the mathematical rigor that you and I talked about and organizations needing that, being somebody who's very details oriented and problem facing focus is very valuable to an organization. On the flip side, if what you want to do is move into that more management, that more leadership, that more strategic kind of a role, that's a different skill set that you would ultimately have to add on to your experiences with data science. And in that space, I would say, certainly EQ and understanding and having that social awareness, because the challenge that a lot of data scientists have is we're very smart and we don't always necessarily appreciate that the people we're talking to might not understand everything that we say, and that can lose your audience profoundly. And that can actually do you a disservice in what you're trying to accomplish. So it's keeping that awareness and being very thoughtful as to how you're presenting what you are presenting to people. And then I would also say it's keeping up that network and really helping yourself by learning about the things that you don't know about. Many data science problems can come from a sideway hall conversation where somebody's saying, I got this, challenge, I don't know what to do. And those are the things that can make a really big impact, and nobody would have known about it unless you're sort of out there exploring what people's challenges are and then helping them with delivering the art of the possible. And I think that that's another area that isn't necessarily intuitive to data science and might be a little uncomfortable to people who tend to be more introverted by nature. But I would highly recommend that people get out there and really allow themselves to get out of their comfort zone and learn some things that they don't know about within the context of the organization that they're working in.
Yeah, good advice, Aubrey. I completely agree with you on that. I know over the years, one of the things I've valued about a number of analysts who worked for me was their economics background. And I think one part alone that helped them was the experience of a mindset that knew they'd have imperfect information and they needed to be able to make good enough assumptions and estimates in order to move on with their thinking. And I've seen a lot of those people cope better with the real world than more pure mathematics or statistics people who wanted precision and a reality that couldn't be achieved in the messy real world.
Oh, absolutely. That's why there's the 80-20 rule, right?
Absolutely.
Data scientists strive too much times for perfection, and trying to get there, you end up losing most of the value that you could have delivered if you just delivered and accepted the fact that it is not a perfect solution just yet. But over time and iteration and with better experiments and with better feedback, you can get it to perfection. But I think a lot of data scientists struggle with allowing their code to get put into practice unless it's absolutely perfect.
Yeah, it's true. Maybe scientists as well. It's kind of a personality thing as well. Brilliant. Aubrey, thank you very much for your thinking. So much useful advice in there. And many thanks for your time today. It's been a pleasure to chat with you.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate you inviting me. And I hope that this has been a good conversation for everybody to listen to. So thank you very much for having me.
You're more than welcome. And thank you, everybody, also for listening. I hope you found that helpful. I'm sure you did. And continue to listen to the Customer Insight Leader podcast. More great interviews coming up. And each week, there's also fresh content on our blog at customerinsightleader.com. So you might want to check that out too. Before then, it just remains me to say thanks, everyone, once again for your time. Have a great week. And perhaps reflect on some of those tips for leaders that Aubrey gave us. Think about whether you're choosing the use cases or providing a balanced diet for your team so they develop their technical skills and they get closer to the business. And think about how you're taking on that responsibility that Aubrey really earned, providing a wayfinder, a guide for people to help them in their development. Something to embrace and maybe some things for us to celebrate about the UK as well. Anyway, thanks for listening, everybody. Bye for now.